Previously on Beta.
And we like to enjoy a vicarious, shall we say, toe in the water of fear.
I get so bored I could scream.
Now come on, squeeze the wheeze. Many people like Joe here.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. These days, we're hearing a lot about the science of happiness. But since happiness is an emotion, and a fleeting one at that, maybe we shouldn't be taking such a rational, objective look at our pursuit of happiness. Maybe we'd be more successful if we started looking for happiness in a much more subjective, much more unscientific way, Paula Poundstone style.
It ended up being this, in addition to the experiments themselves, this 7-year chronology of, you know, basically my kids growing up and leaving.
And we'll explore They Might Be Giants' 1990 album, Flood.
I feel like the song really says, you know what, you're allowed to like the things that you like, even if they are patently ridiculous, and that's totally okay.
But we're going to get things started with Scott Thompson. Scott was one of the members of the Canadian comedy troupe Kids in the Hall. Their subversive sketch comedy series aired on HBO and the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation in the late 80s and early 90s. 20 years later, the kids' comedy holds up incredibly well. That's partly because they were ahead of their time. And I think it also has a lot to do with the kids' excellent acting skills. These guys fully inhabited their characters in a way that no comedy troupe has done before or since. Take, for example, Scott Thompson's famous creation, Buddy Cole. Buddy is an effeminate gay socialite with a tendency to lisp. And he's not only out there with his sexuality, he is out there with his opinions. There's nothing that Buddy Cole will not speak his mind about. In 1998, Scott Thompson and Kids in the Hall writer Paul Bellini collaborated on a book called Buddy Babylon, the autobiography of Buddy Cole. Buddy Cole was an icon at an especially homophobic time in comedy and in the culture at large. Now, 20 years later, this faux memoir has been republished. And just a warning, Scott uses a slur that some listeners may find offensive. Here's Scott Thompson as Buddy Cole.
They say that the exact circumstances of a person's birth determines the course of the rest of his or her life. In my case, this was profoundly so. Let me explain. I was born on February 29th, 1960, a leap year, thereby celebrating my birthday every 4 years. It was inevitable I would be a homosexual. Imagine, even when I'm 80, in some places I'll still be too young to drink. Now, to look at me, you'd think that I was hatched from a Fabergé egg, the scion of a lost branch of one of the royal houses of Europe. For years, this is what I actually told people. But now that I've been given money to tell my life story, I feel the truth threatening to break through. No, dear reader, I was not born with a silver spoon in my mouth, more like a rusty fork. Now, before I launch you on the thrill ride that is my life, I must give you some background information. Think of it as foreplay. So lay back and spread your legs, because some of this stuff is pretty hard to swallow. You'll need every hole you've got. I was born on a pig farm in northern Quebec, Canada, in a little hamlet of 2,000 people called Saint-Hubert-sur-la-Lac, or St. Hubert on the Lake. As far as I know, there was never actually a St. Hubert, but there was a St. Hubert's chicken restaurant nearby, so that must have been where the name came from. I was the last of 23 children. I was christened Charles Butterick Cole. The Charles was after Charles Boyer, Maman's favorite actor. The Butterick, after my paternal grandfather. Everyone called me Butterick, though, until one day my father shortened it to Buddy by mistake, and it stuck. My parents, Angus Sean Cole, a lusty Scotsman who arrived in Quebec in 1920 at the age of 15, and my mother, Giselle Christiane Lavigne, the only child of Quebecois pig farmers, met at a cockfight in 1930 and married soon after. My family operated in both official languages. We spoke French to our mother and Scottish to our father. From what I saw, they loved each other very much. That's probably why I turned out so stable. Mama doted on Papa's brusque Scottish virility, and Papa adored Mama, who was no looker. But she had a jolie spirit, a good heart, and most importantly, came with a farm. People today are almost offended that my parents had such a big family, that they were somehow enviro-terrorists. But I figure, if it took that many children to produce me, then it was worth the extra burden on the planet. Did I go too far?
No, that was exactly right. Well, okay. No, you didn't go too far literally, nor did you go too far figuratively.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
People keep saying that I'm going too far, but it doesn't seem like it's happening.
Yeah.
I feel like a buddy can't go far enough for society right now.
Yeah, exactly. I think you're right. So this book, Buddy Babylon, is very funny, and the energy, flow, and pace is impeccable. Why hasn't this been turned into a movie yet?
Why did it even not get reviewed 20 years ago?
Yeah, tell me about that.
The book was released into a storm of nothingness. No one reviewed it. No one talked about it. It sold, and mm-hmm. It never was off the shelves. I never saw it in a bargain bin, but nobody touched it. No one reviewed it. No one talked about it. It was as if gay people were ashamed of it, and straight people didn't want to say they loved it because it would make people think they were fags. Mm. And you have to recall that 20 years ago was a vastly different world. And so now, 20 years later, my belief is that people are ready for this book. Because mm-hmm. It is the best thing and the funniest thing I've ever done. It broke my heart that no one paid it any mind. And now I really think it's time for people to give the book the credit that it's due.
Yeah, it's well overdue. While reading it, I couldn't help but think of movies like Forrest Gump and Zelig.
Oh, I want this to be a movie so badly.
Buddy has this uncanny ability to give birth to this dreary modern phenomena a la Forrest Gump and Zelig. And you and your co-author, Paul Bellini, must have had a lot of fun deciding which things Buddy would be responsible for.
Oh, absolutely. That was one of the very things at the beginning we decided on, that Buddy would be at the center of every major social, historical movement, and that somehow he would always be at the center of it. And very much, Zelig was definitely very much one of the models for it.
Yeah, it really is. It really is a wonderful book.
And I think so. Thank you.
I'd like to talk to you about the origin story of Charles Butterick, Buddy Cole. When did you first create him?
Well, I first created him with Paul Bellini. Everything starts with Paul. Basically, I guess it would have been the mid-80s, in a period of my life when everything was happening. I met the kids in the hall. I just started to try to do stand-up. Paul had just bought a video camera, which was very key. And this is the day when people didn't go around documenting their lives.
Yeah.
And Paul Bellini was a real outlier and a real early adopter, and he bought a video camera, and he proceeded to basically document our whole group of friends. And because Paul and I were both gay men in the 80s and AIDS hit, I think that in many ways we were so cursed that we retreated into art. I just really had this feeling that we were all going to die. So Paul and I just basically started documenting everything. And then one afternoon, we were in Paul's place, and we were in his room, which was full of blue paintings from his friend Randall Finnerty. And I just said, "It's my blue period." And he turned the camera on and goes, "Start talking." And I started talking like Buddy Cole. I started doing that accent, that voice. Yeah. And I started saying, the first stuff I started saying was, "I'm a vampire. I'm 1,000 years old." And so that was the initial impulse was, but Buddy Cole was, I probably just read Interview with a Vampire.
Oh, yeah, Anne Rice, right?
So one of the models for Buddy Cole was that. Like, this is a man that's been around forever and knows everyone and is the star of his life. And I just had an affair with a guy that was very effeminate. And, you know, like most gay men, I was filled with self-loathing about my own effeminacy. Mm-hmm. And I'd never met a man like this guy before. And he was effeminate, but I found him very attractive. And it kind of threw me because his femininity was like weaponized. And he was handsome and smart as a whip, French-Canadian guy. We had a brief affair, and then he dumped me unceremoniously, quite cavalierly. Mm. And then he got sick, and he died. And he was one of the first to go, and he went so quickly. I think that was the voice that I started to imitate, was him.
Yeah.
So that's where it began.
Yeah. If you don't mind my asking, did you create the character of Buddy Cole before you came out as gay?
No. No, they all came at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Paul and I had a punk band called Mouth Congress. We started performing. I started doing Buddy Cole. I met the kids in the hall. All of these things happened at the same time, all in the mid-80s. Everything just changed for me.
Wow. So how did the first Buddy Cole monologue that you did, the first one for Kids in the Hall. How did that go over?
Well, it went over like gun. What is it? Gangbusters. Yeah. That's it. Gunbusters.
I ain't afraid of no guns.
No, it went over very, very well. It's different now. Like back then, a lot of it was just the idea of playing a character like that was outrageous.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people laughed just at the way I moved, the way I spoke. Mm-hmm. They're just, people are conditioned to laugh at the effeminate male.
Yeah, and maybe some of it was uncomfortable laughter too.
Absolutely. It's a very different world now. I look back on it and I think a lot of the laughter came from people just literally feeling superior to the character in a way. But then the problem is Buddy Cole feels superior to you, so you can't really feel superior to him. He will smack you down.
Yeah.
And I think now I'm a much better joke writer. But back then, I think a lot of the laughter came from the language, because I've always been a literary guy. So a lot of it was just the language that I chose and the way that I moved and spoke. And now I think that I'm actually a better writer and that I'm a better joke writer and that Buddy is in many ways funnier. Dave tells a story when we were doing a show, and afterwards a bunch of guys came up to us and said, "I love it how you're sticking it to the fags." And Dave's like, "Well, we're not sticking it to the fags. This is a fag." And they're like, "Come on, no fag would act like that. No one would do that deliberately." And I'm like, "Yeah, well, I would." The idea that someone would be openly gay and portray a character like that was unheard of. Just unheard of.
Yeah. Well, and as you mentioned, it was a very different time back then. And
oh my God, it's like another dimension. I can't even believe it's the same planet.
But isn't it kind of similar in terms of, like, I think I read somewhere where you said that now is also a very polarizing time.
I find it a very similar time, which is why I think Buddy's having a moment and why there's this, I think, a groundswell for to bring the Kids in the Hall back, because I think we're needed right now. We're very good when society is in free fall.
Yeah. And also, you guys are ahead of your time.
Yes, and I think we actually are again. We're ahead of the trend, and I think that it would be wonderful for us to come back. And I think that one of the reasons Buddy's doing so well right now is because people have to listen to him. Even if you're a young social justice warrior who doesn't like to hear anyone say fag or things like that, you have to listen to this guy because he's a war vet, and he's got wounds, and you have to listen. You just have to. Kids have to go, "Grandpa knows what he's talking about."
That's for sure, yeah. One of the beautiful things about Buddy is that he doesn't seem to have a censor, you know, like
none.
An inner sense. There's no inner censor. He can say anything he wants and get away with it.
It's amazing. My show is appalling. The show I'm doing now is just appalling. I cannot believe the things I say. I keep track of rape jokes through my show. It's ridiculous. And people say, "You can't say that." I go, "Well, of course you can. You can say anything if it's funny enough."
Yeah.
I mean, this idea that there are certain things that are taboo is, to me, an outrageous idea. You make jokes about murder, and there's nothing worse than murder. So, of course, everything can be touched by comedy. Everything.
Yeah, including AIDS.
Absolutely. Everything. There's nothing that comedy can't touch. And I think this notion that's growing in liberal circles, that there are certain things that are untouchable is very dangerous, and I reject it.
New York Magazine's culture website, Vulture, included Buddy on their list of 100 more jokes that shape modern comedy, and they wrote that Buddy wasn't just a gay character talking about being gay. The genius of Buddy is that he was a gay character that talked about everything, even things like racism. And they went on to say that Buddy Cole helped change the tide of how gay men were represented in comedy.
"They say that whites are smarter than blacks, but dumber than Orientals. I guess we're just right." "We're the porridge that Goldilocks chose. Not too hot like those saucy Africans, but not too cold like those chilly Chinese."
Buddy was a warrior. I mean, I think of myself as a warrior, and I think of Buddy Cole as my armor in a way.
That's a great way of looking at it.
And Buddy Cole was the first through the door. And
yeah.
You pay for that. You pay a high price for that. But he was a warrior. He is a warrior. And now it's like almost like I'm like a superhero that's been buried for 20 years. And now they're coming in saying, it's your time. Get up. You got to go.
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny that you mentioned that first through the door, because it makes me think of the experimental art band The Residents and their theory.
Yeah.
Their theory of obscurity. Are you familiar
with
this theory?
Very much so, yeah. I'm familiar with everybody who's obscure that hasn't gotten their due.
Yeah, but for those of our listeners who don't know it, the Residents theory of obscurity is the idea that an artist can only produce pure art when he or she ignores the commercial pressures of the outside world, and then the artist's work may not become popular, but instead it's the imitators that will enjoy commercial success.
Absolutely. This is something I've learned in my life, is that there's no money in first.
Yeah.
There's actually no money even in second. Second's the real chump change. Because then you get nothing. You're not first, so the history books aren't going to, you know, say you were first, because eventually the person who's first will get their credit, maybe long after they're dead. But it's third which gets the money and fame and glory while they're alive.
Yeah.
And that's what I've discovered, is that it's third. If you're someone that wants money and fame in your own life, be third. Wait.
Yeah.
If that's what you want.
Yeah. But that doesn't.
But art does. I totally agree. Art operates completely independent of society.
Yeah. There's a sentence late in Buddy Babylon where Buddy says, quote, "My goal is not to shock and horrify, but to tell the truth. And if that truth shocks and horrifies, well, maybe you should just get out more," end quote.
And that couldn't be truer today, where we have, you know, an army of, like, you know, keyboard warriors who really need to get some sun. They really need to get out there and skin their knee.
Yeah, keyboard warriors, that's great. So that's not just Buddy Cole's goal, it's also Scott Thompson's goal,
it is.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
So, yeah, you've said that you think a lot of people still assume that Buddy Cole is who you are.
Yeah, they do. And they constantly publish pictures of Buddy Cole and then put my name under it, which used to really bother me. Now I'm kind of philosophical about it, because I go, well, it's not me. But before, I used to think, well, God, everybody will think I'm that faggy. And, you know, and I'm hopefully a little more accepting of myself now. But, you know, like, I look to my, like one of my heroes is Barry Humphries, who's the man behind
Dame Edna. Yeah. And he was also in Bedazzled.
He's my biggest influence. And I look at him and I go, no one puts a picture of Barry Humphries and says Dame Edna, or no one puts a picture of Dame Edna and says Barry Humphries. And I don't know if I'll ever get that, but that's kind of what I want. I want people to see Buddy Cole as a real person. And me, not so much.
Scott Thompson is the co-author, along with Paul Bellini, of Buddy Babylon, the autobiography of Buddy Cole. You can find out more about Scott and Buddy on our website, wpr.org/beta. And we'd love to know what you think of the show. You can email us at beta@wpr.org. We'll talk to Paula Poundstone about her search for happiness, a search that was totally unscientific and totally Poundstone-esque. That's coming up right after this. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta. What exactly is happiness? According to Charles M. Schulz's beloved Peanuts comic strip, there are a number of different ways to define happiness. For example, happiness is a warm puppy. But happiness is also two kinds of ice cream. However we define happiness, it's safe to say that we're all searching for it. And comedian Paula Poundstone is no exception. But Paula being Paula, she decided to search for it in a rather unusual way. A totally unscientific way. Paula chronicles her journey in a book called The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. So how does she define happiness?
Sadly, it's very unromantic. It's a biochemical process.
Yeah.
And I say that as the author of The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness, but it is. It's all the things that your parents told you. That's the other thing I that's upsetting about it. Get some exercise. Go outside, socialize, and pitch in and help. Those are probably the main things.
If it is indeed a biochemical process, which I believe you are right, then why did you want to search for happiness in a totally unscientific way?
I don't think I gathered that yet. So I guess I sort of learned it as I went along. But the other thing is, as a writer, I knew that the experiments themselves would be good playgrounds for writing jokes.
Oh, yeah.
And then the other thing, I knew that the real question for me was certainly not what do I enjoy doing, because I have a handle on what I enjoy doing. The real question was, what could I do that would leave me with a bounce, you know, so that when I return to my regular life of raising a house full of kids and animals and being a stand-up comic and just being stuck being me 24 hours a day, you know, that I had some residual good feeling to carry me through the challenges of my regular life. And therefore, I knew before I even began writing that the sort of crux of the book would be where I checked back in and saw how my regular life was going. What I didn't know is that it would take me 7 years to write. And there were lots of surprises to me as a writer, but it ended up being this, in addition to the experiments themselves, this 7-year chronology of, you know, basically my kids growing up and leaving.
Yeah, that's an interesting part, and that adds this layer of kind of sadness to the whole book, which is very intriguing. Adds a whole nother level there. You got some pathos going in there. So you decided to take the immersion journalism approach in your totally unscientific study. You followed in the footsteps of such immersive journalists as George Plimpton, Ted Conover, and more recently A.J. Jacobs. Why did you want to take this approach?
Well, this is a terrible declaration of ignorance, but one of the things that I thought when I first came up with the idea was that the publisher would be willing to pay for the experiments.
Mm.
Now, I haven't drank for, I don't know, 16 years or so, but I must have had some sort of, you know, residual high when I came up with that idea.
Yeah.
Because I had this idea that, you know, I would get the chance to do these potentially, you know, happiness rewarding things, and someone else would pay for it, which I must say would have doubled the happiness for sure.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, you can buy happiness, it seems. The first experiment you undertook was the Get Fit experiment, and that seems like a perfectly logical place to start because there's a lot of scientific evidence indicating that exercise does make us happy. But me, being the reckless pessimist that I am, I have to wonder if all of this research is just a bunch of junk science paid for by the gymnasium industrial complex. What do you think?
The truth is, if because I really did go in not knowing.
Yeah.
If I had realized the success that I would achieve in the happiness department from the Get Fit experiment, I would have put it later in the book.
Mm.
Because, you know, it'd be great to sort of build too. But I
sure.
really did go in naively, and it didn't occur to me right away. I mean, I really was experimenting. What I would do is, in the case of that experiment, there's a Taekwondo self-defense studio about 6 or 7 blocks from my house. And I have no passion, by the way, for Taekwondo or self-defense. The reason I chose that studio was it's the closest one to my house. And although I wanted to get fit, I didn't want to have to walk that far to do it.
Of course not.
So I went to the guy. I signed up for as many classes as I could in, you know, around my schedule, which was, you know, probably, it varied from week to week, but it was, I'd say, 3, 4, 5 a week, depending on the week. And I just sort of, you know, when I would come home from his studio, I would sit down with a notebook and write my field notes.
Yeah, right.
And then, so one day I'm walking down the alley behind my house, carrying about 30 pounds, I think, of cat waste and litter in a trash bag.
Yeah.
And I'm walking to the trash cans down the alley. And all of a sudden, it dawned on me that I felt good. I mean, it just felt good. And I thought to myself, okay, it has to be working out, because I have carried huge bags of animal waste down this alley many, many, many times, and I don't ever recall feeling like, hey, this is great. I'm hoping it's not the cat waste, because, whew.
Yeah,
I don't want that to be the source of happiness.
No, no, I don't think any of us do. So the Get Fit experiment did bring you closer to happiness.
Yeah, I think it really did. I mean, I describe it in the book, and I would stand by that description, as that I felt, sometimes it felt, not during the workout, by the way. The workouts themselves were grueling. I was often about to cry or throw up very hard, except for I enjoyed the company of the guy that was the trainer. But when I wasn't doing that, when I was just experiencing, as I said, this sort of residual feeling that I got from it, I remember, and I recorded in the book, feeling like when I breathed in, it felt like I was breathing in possibility.
That's great. You say that the human species has never come up with a standard form of measurement for happiness, and that this could have something to do with why we have so much trouble figuring out how happy we are. Do you have any ideas about what we could call units of measurement for happiness?
I did come up because I realized that when I went to write this, you know, like I had to quantify it somehow.
Yes.
In order to express, you know, whether or not the thing was giving me happiness or at what point it did. So I came up with, let's see, HEPs of happiness are sort of a small, I don't know what that word is, you know.
Unit of measurement?
Unit
yeah.
of measurement.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And four HEPs would complete a Baloo of happiness. And a Baloo of happiness is substantial.
Yeah. Where did you get those names from?
These are some of my cats.
Yeah. So I extrapolating that, I wonder if what would you call the happiest you've ever been? Would we use your cat ShamWow's name, like, and say, this is the ShamWowiest day of my life? What do you think?
You know, ShamWow has not yet ascended in the pride high enough to have a unit of happiness measure named after her.
Yeah, and then, of course, if some of the countries don't like the names you've come up with, and I don't see how you could not like them, but if they didn't, they could just come up with their own alternative happiness measurement system, like the metric system, right?
Well, that's true. That didn't mess everybody up badly enough.
No.
I think we have to have cohesion. Plus, I just love the idea of hearing. You know how sometimes there'll be a word that's like, it's not just an English word, it's an American word.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll hear somebody speaking another language, but there is no translation for that word. And so it'll be like, blah, 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 ShamWow, blah, 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 blah,
yeah,
blah.
Yeah.
I love that. Yeah. So I love the idea of a HEP and a Baloo being a universal term.
Yeah, I think it's great. We got to make that happen somehow. So which one of your happiness experiments, which one of the 13 taught you the most about happiness?
Well, I guess I'm going to come at this from the reverse.
Sure.
I think, just like when I started out as a comic, I used to watch other comics. And if somebody was really good, honestly, I couldn't tell what they were doing.
Mm. They made it so it seemed so effortless, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And it was theirs anyway.
Right, yeah.
And I don't mean the exact words, but whereas if I watch someone who wasn't good or who that particular performance I saw wasn't good, then I really learned something. And I guess in using that same very negative approach, which is sort of my hallmark, the Get Wired experiment ended up being really, really important in this book. Everybody kept saying to me, oh my gosh, what do you mean you don't use a computer? Oh, if you use it, you'd be so, you are going to love computers because it's going to make you so, so much happier. And the one that we had at the house, you know, the kids used it for school stuff and they played on it when they were little. And so I believed that idea. So, in fact, so much so that when I began the Get Wired experiment, I did it with real zeal. I was very excited about it. I went out, I bought a laptop. I got somebody, you know, some tech teachy guy to come teach me how to do some stuff on it. And I really had every hope and expectation of this improving my life and my level of happiness exponentially. And what's interesting is, as I said, I went through this process where I would take notes. You know, I did the things. I started making videos to post on YouTube. I had the goofy Facebook account. Yeah. I started Twitter, you know, all the stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
The stuff, the email, the stuff that everybody's so excited about. Again, with every expectation of this making me happy. And then I would take notes on, you know, using it just and how life was going, raising the kids and animals, just the same as I'd done with the other experiments. When I went to do the rewrite on the book, some of those chapters I had not looked at since I wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
And given that it took 7 years to write the book, by the time I went to do the rewrite on the book, that I'd been using a computer for a while at that point. And so I send everything off to the editor, and it comes back. And what's really funny was, she would circle words that I reused too much.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I didn't notice it at the time because I was forcing myself to just put the pen to the page, just write it, just write it and get through it, and then deal with, making it correct later. You would not believe how many times the words lonely and tired were circled.
Wow.
And I hadn't written the chapter. I had no intention of damning technology. I really looked forward to it. I really thought that I was, on the outside looking in because everybody else was doing this stuff. And the other thing that happens unplanned and unheralded and unwelcome in the book is that I end up chronicling my son's descent into electronics addiction, which is a real thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
A very serious thing in our kids in particular. I mean, it's not good for any of us, but for children with developing brains, it's a disastrous combination. And so it was just really fascinating by the time I got to the end of writing it all, and then I'm reading it, and I'm going, wow, I didn't realize what I had chronicled when I chronicled it. But I really did go from being almost entirely a blank slate with computer technology. I mean, it was an experiment that almost nobody else has done,
yeah.
Which is take someone who hasn't touched it, really, and now sort of immerse yourself in it and see how you feel. And the answer is not good.
Yeah. So is it possible that learning to use a computer, was that the experiment that made you the most unhappy?
I would say, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It was only rivaled by the process of getting organized. Not actually feeling organized felt great. When on the rare occasion when I had that feeling, but one of my chapters was, in fact, two of my chapters, I did the Get Organized chapter part one and the Get Organized chapter part two.
Yeah.
And that was grueling. Once I had gotten through it, it does feel good, actually. It feels really good. But the process is really depressing.
Yeah, it's some real tough sledding. So what was the most surprising thing you learned about happiness while writing this book and undertaking all these experiments? Can you point to one thing?
I don't know. I mean, I think this fact that it really is this biochemical process and how much of it has little to do with the circumstances of one's life. And now I'm saying that as a fairly privileged person, I live a pretty comfortable life.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe if I was in another circumstance, then this wouldn't be this way. In the process of writing the Get Fit experiment, one of my best friends died, and my dog died, and I went to visit injured service people at Walter Reed.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those were, they were points where you would, under normal circumstances in my life, those are things that would have laid me pretty low. And it's not that I didn't feel, it's not like my best friend died and I felt pretty good. I felt sad, but I didn't feel overwhelmed.
Mm.
I didn't feel like I would never stand up again or that I was sinking. I could still see and feel a future, but in the moment it was sad, which is very different from how I often feel. I heard a great thing the other day. I was at a conference in Boston on screens and the developing brain.
Mm-hmm.
I heard this thing that I had never heard before, and it was so impactful to me. Hope requires imagination. And I thought that was so stunning. So you have to develop imagination in order to feel hopeful. And in the case of the Get Fit experiment, it definitely left one with a hopeful feeling. So that as one lives one life like a bowling pin, as things come at you, you're not necessarily knocked down by them.
Mm, that's a good way of putting it. Final question, Paula. Are you now more capable of experiencing happiness? Are you more happy at times?
Oh, yeah. I'm definitely using the results Yeah, I'd be a fool not to, I think. You know, it's funny when we were in the editing process, the editor kept saying to me, I don't think she really understood entirely what I was doing. She said, the readers won't understand why you stopped working out if it made you feel good.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to her, for science, because you have to isolate the variables.
Yeah.
The only two things that I didn't stop doing when I finished with that chapter in order to go on to the next one were I continued to use the silly, stupid computer, even though clearly it wasn't making me happy.
No.
And the other thing is when I started volunteering at a nursing home, I never stopped. I've been there for a couple of years now because I had what I needed for the purposes of writing after a couple of months, but it just didn't feel right to go like, okay, got what I need, see ya.
Yeah, yeah.
I have stayed there. But I just, I don't know, months ago went back to working out, and I have to say, it's good just like it was the first time.
Paula Poundstone is a comedian and the author of the totally unscientific study of the search for human happiness. You can find out more about Paula at our website, wpr.org/beta. And we'd love to know what you think of the show. You can get in touch with us by sending an email to beta@wpr.org.
Minimum Wage is 45 seconds of glory. It's a song that starts off with just the call, Minimum Wage, and then we hear a whip cracking. Whoosh, yeah.
We check out They Might Be Giants' 1990 album, Flood, to find out how it redefined geek culture. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta. In 1990, John Flansburgh and John Linnell, alias They Might Be Giants, released their major label debut album, Flood. Flood is TMBG's best-selling album and is widely considered to be the band's best. But there's more to Flood than that. The album demonstrates that geek identity doesn't have to rely on references to Spock ears and hobbits. That's the argument that S. Alexander Reed and Philip Sandifer make in their book, Flood, which is part of the 33 and a third series of books about albums. Reed joins us to talk about They Might Be Giants' Flood.
Why is the world in love again? Why are we marching hand in hand? Why are the ocean levels rising up? It's a brand new record for 1990. They Might Be Giants' brand new album, Flood.
Why does They Might Be Giants' 1990 album, Flood, matter?
So a lot of They Might Be Giants fans don't actually point to Flood as their favorite album. But for a huge number of fans, Flood was the album that brought them in. Part of this was the fact that they had just signed with Elektra Records, a major label which had the marketing power to gain a larger audience than they had had before that. But more interestingly, I think that for a lot of fans, 1990 was a moment when the fringes of culture that they had existed on, and let's not beat around the bush too much, a lot of their fans at the time fit into a sort of nerd or sort of a geek mold, right? And not all of them, of course, and lots of people don't like those terms, but that still is very much the niche that they've been put in, for better or for worse. And that was, I think, right around the time when that stopped being a pejorative thing, right around the time when that stopped being a strictly bad thing. And if you start looking at who is on the cultural ascendant at that moment in 1990, that's when your Garry Kasparovs and your Bill Gateses of the world start to become a culturally visible force, and when people start saying, well, geez, I'm going to own this identity. I'm going to declare myself proudly geekish. I'm going to wave that freak flag.
Yes, well said indeed. That's part of the reason, of course, that it is such a cultural touchstone for geek culture, for lack of a better term. Can you take me back to the first time you heard the album?
Yeah. I was at this camp called CTY, Center for Talented Youth. This was a thing run by the Johns Hopkins Talent Search. I was, for the first time in my life, alongside not just a few kids in my class who were interested in the same stuff or who really enjoyed doing math in the same way that I did, but there were hundreds and hundreds of us. And so there's this giddy energy because we're all, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old, really. And when you put a bunch of kids like that all in one place and tell them to be as smart and weird and crazy as they want to be, there's a kind of magic in the air. And their music, the Mappy Giants music, was some of the fuel that kept that entire experience going. I think a lot of people had similar experiences where they heard this music maybe from an older sibling or from some kid who was just one notch cooler than you were on some scale, right? Even when the Mappy Giants did make it to the top 10 in the UK, as they did with the song Birdhouse in Your Soul, I think a lot of the people who heard it instantly recognized that this was different, that this was not like the other stuff that was charting. And when you feel something is just for you, even if it isn't widely popular, that popularity has a kind of depth to it. You end up sticking with it and you end up saying, well, geez, I'm not just going to buy this one single, but I'm going to go and investigate everything this band does.
Yeah, and that was like the perfect setting for you to hear that album for the first time. It's like something out of a Wes Anderson film almost.
Look at her in the alley by the light switch. Who watches over you? Make a little birdhouse in your soul. Not to put too fine a point on it. Say I'm the only bee in your bonnet. Make a little birdhouse in your soul.
So the lead single from the album is this song called Birdhouse in Your Soul, which reached number 3 on the Billboard Modern Rock Tracks chart. And you say that this song is musically complex. Can you unpack the musical complexity of Birdhouse in Your Soul for us?
Oh, I would love to.
Excellent. I would love to hear you do it.
Yeah. Birdhouse in Your Soul is a really interesting song. It's ostensibly in C major. It starts and ends in C major. But it goes through a bunch of different keys along the way. Even in the first 10 seconds of the song, it starts borrowing chords from other keys and goes into B-flat, and then it's got this weird thing that we call a Neapolitan chord. It sort of steers around in a bunch of different directions, and it never really sits still. So thinking again back to the class clown, you know, the ADHD mindset that can't sit still, it kind of reflects that. It goes through something like 18 key changes, depending on how you count it, right?
Wow.
You know, the chorus itself keeps alternating back and forth between C and E flat, and then the bridge goes through A minor and A and F sharp, and it's this ridiculous barrage, again, this kind of flood-like nature of ideas, this idea that we can't sit still. And then lyrically, and this is where I think a lot of people most engage with the song, the song is about a nightlight, right? The song is about a blue canary-shaped nightlight that you plug into a child's wall, which has got this kind of childlike innocence to it that pervades a lot of the Mappy Giants music. But then in describing it, they bring in this entire universe of metaphors where they're talking about Jason and the Argonauts, right? And they're talking about the nature of friendship.
Yeah, the Longines.
Yeah, right. They're talking about wristwatches and things like that. All of these really strange references just from left field. And it's not showing off. And that's maybe the thing that I love the most about this band is that they're not flashy. And that's one of the things that keeps the Mappy Giants from ever really sounding like a novelty act. They never sound like they're trying to make a joke. Instead, the strangeness, the genuine eccentricity of their music is being presented as part of the personality and never as a put-on. It's always just right there, to the point where when you speak to John Flansburg and John Linnell about it, they almost bristle a little bit because that's part of who they are. And that's, I think, how a lot of fans feel. It's part of how they are, is this sense that why would you draw attention to the way my brain works? That is the state of affairs.
I want to ask you about the song Dead, because even by They Might Be Giants standards, Dead has some pretty bizarre lyrics, doesn't it?
Yeah. Here's the thing, though. Dead is a song that is about a thing. It's just the thing that it's about is so bizarre, right? It is about being reincarnated as a bag of groceries, and that's really it.
I came back as a bag of groceries, accidentally taken off the shelf before the day stamped on my sand. Did a large procession wave their torches as my head fell.
And there are some regrets that come along with that. The second verse, I will never say the word procrastinate again. I'll never see myself in the mirror with my eyes closed.
I will never say the word procrastinate again. I'll never see myself in the mirror with my eyes closed.
The two lines that if I were going to have a be buried, which I'm not, I'll be cremated, but I would want on my tombstone, the two lines would be,
now it's over, I'm dead and I haven't done anything that I want. Or I'm still alive and there's nothing I want to do.
Right. There's a kind of workmanlike listlessness and sense of matter-of-fact regret that comes in that song. And that's not particularly uncommon. I think that, again, the idea that we have unfinished business and that at the same time we're too lazy to finish it, even though we have time now that we're alive, that's really common. That's something that lots of people can relate to. It's just the packaging that's so strange. Yeah, literally the packaging. They talk about being reincarnated as a bag of groceries from whence you can't really do anything, right? It's a really appealing song in both its foreignness of central metaphor, but also the familiarity of the thing that it's referencing.
Yeah.
That goes along with a lot of what they're saying. And also, it models a kind of transmodality. It models a sense that you don't have to just be yourself, that you could be anything you want to be. And if you listen to the Epigiants music, you'll hear lots of instances of one thing magically turning into another, you know, the nightlight turning into Jason and the Argonauts, to give just one example, or for that matter, a rapid genre shift, guitars turning into trumpets.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's a very freeing thing. When I was young and I heard this music, to me, it kind of told me that you don't have to be what people expect you to be, that you can be one thing one minute and another thing the other minute, and that allows for a real kind of complexity. And I feel like that's especially important in a day these days when there's so much emphasis on, oh, let's say personal branding, right? On becoming one thing that you can sum up in 140 characters.
Yeah. They Might Be Giants universe is a world of infinite possibilities.
Yeah, exactly.
And in a world where we're trying to be slotted into you're this, you're that, it's refreshing and it's heartening and kind of gives you hope for the future. I want to ask you about one of my favorite songs from Flood, We Want a Block.
Where was I? I forgot the point that I was making. I said if I was smart that I would save up for a piece of string and a rock to wind the string around.
What's your take on this one?
The music for We Want to Rock is largely lifted from traditional New England contra dance, and so you've got this idea of circularity, this idea of things always coming back, because the contra dance is it's a social dance where the band plays through the A section and the B section in alternation as many times as they want to, right, as long as the people still feel like dancing. And so it kind of describes this process of people saying, all right, we want to rock, nope, now we want prosthetic foreheads, and it's sort of describing fads, right?
Yes, exactly.
And so one verse, it might be one fad. Another verse, it might be another fad. And so on the one hand, it's kind of saying that the circularity is interchangeable, right? Everybody wants prosthetic foreheads on their real heads. It's patently a ridiculous idea, right? So there's that. But
yes.
On the other hand, the music's got this B section that talks about, you know, the bullies of the world, right? Someone in this town wants to burn the foreheads down, wants to burn your playhouse down, and they basically want to stop you from having fun.
On my hood, I'd collect the $7 and I'd buy a big prosthetic forehead and wear it on my real head. Everybody wants prosthetic foreheads on their real heads. Everybody wants prosthetic foreheads on their real heads.
These people might be the naysayers who say, oh, that's just a fad, you don't really need that or whatever, but I think that the song ultimately comes out as a defense of simple pleasures. I feel like the song really says, you know what, you're allowed to like the things that you like, even if they are patently ridiculous, and that's totally okay. And I think it's a very life-affirming song in the way that it stands up for our right to participate in a fad and get the social pleasure from that, even as we're parading around like fools.
One final song that I have to ask you about is Minimum Wage. What's your take on Minimum Wage?
Minimum Wage is 45 seconds of glory. It's a song that starts off with just the call, Minimum Wage, and then we hear a whip cracking. Whoosh, yeah.
Minimum Wage!
And the song kind of saunters along. That bit about minimum wage, well, two things about it. One, I have a lot of friends who sing that song when they're on their way to work. You know, they'll say, all right, well, here I am off to make another dollar, whoop-de-doo, minimum wage, whoosh. And so it becomes a kind of sardonic call of the blue collar. And then on the other hand, going back to this idea of it existing in this universe of cool, The song just kind of peters out and stops after 45 seconds. It's almost like it's embarrassed to exist, which is a kind of funny thing. It's like someone stepping out and saying, look at me, and then realizing that everyone's looking at him and saying, oh, never mind, and then, you know, sort of stepping back as the whip crack could almost double as a locker room towel snap or something like that.
Hang on tight.
Tabloid footprints in your
S. Alexander Reed is the co-author, along with Philip Sandifer, of Flood, a book about They Might Be Giants' 1990 album. It's part of the 33 and a Third series.
They might be giants.
Four.
They might be giants.
Four.
They might be giants.
Four. That's it for this edition of Beta. Let us know what you think of the show. Send your thoughts in an email to beta@wpr.org. You can become an alpha. Just give us a follow on Twitter. Our handle is @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Special thanks to our technical director and music director, Steve Gotcher.
Does he wear a cape? Be honest. Does he wear a cape to work?
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
How we doing, Adam? You're a little slow, aren't you, boy?
And thanks to you, our alphas, for listening. And until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
Are you Canadian, really? Then how did you say that? How could you pronounce it like that? You've been here a long time.